Hello, my fans, friends. Welcome to the Rich Herring podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Thanks to everyone who's come to see the Can I Have My Ball Back tour so far. It's been going really well. I've got a 4-star review in The Standard, 4-star review in The Telegraph, who once called me the worst comedy experience of the year, so that's a turnaround. People have been coming, people have really been enjoying it, and it's getting better and better. The only gigs this week are both in Pocklington, the town I was born in, near York. There's a couple of tickets left for the evening show and a few more tickets left for the matinee, I think about 4:30. But love to see you there, Yorkshire. Pop along. Check richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs to see if I'm coming near to you. There are tickets left for nearly every show in the tour. I think Norwich has sold out. And a couple of gigs in London could do with your support as well. Anyway, please listen to the podcast. Do spread the news about the podcast to your friends. Listen as much as you can. Numbers are slightly down, which may affect the future of this podcast. So just leave it playing, even if you're not in the room. Love you. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy whatever it is you're going to listen to.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
You are about to listen to Rich Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast with my guest this week, Alexi Sale. How exciting is that? Quite exciting, I think you will agree. It is free, but there are lots of ways for you to contribute if you want to help us keep this going and to come up with even more comedy ideas. We don't want the money for ourselves. We want it to make new stuff. So why don't you go to www.gofasterstripe.com, RHLSTP5, where you can buy downloads, video downloads or audio downloads of this entire series for various amounts of money. You can also choose to make a one-off donation in return for a badge from a pound upwards, or a monthly donation would be fantastic if you're prepared to give us just a pound a month. If everyone who listened to this did this, we could create a media empire that would take down Rupert Murdoch and make kebabs out of his liver. And that is a promise. If 150,000 people do that, we will make that happen. But even if a few of you could do that, that would mean we can make things like a video version of As It Occurs to Me. You'd like to see that, wouldn't you? We can't do that without your input. You are the commissioning editors. Your money, your pound a month could make all the difference. Or come and see me on tour. Check out richardherring.com and you can see my upcoming tour dates. You can buy mugs and t-shirts and hoodies at richardherring.cottoncart.com as well. Okay, here's the show. You've had enough of an advert. I will never mention this again, I promise. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Leicester Square Theatre. Please welcome a man with an infected finger. It's Richard Herring. That's my infected finger. I'm not being rude. So hello, welcome to Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast, or as all the cool kids are calling it, Rehelester Purr. Whoa, there's lots of you, that's good. I've been quite healthy this year and been keeping quite fit, but like this weekend I've been stricken down with various ailments. Welcome to me. I'm getting old now, so I'm just talking about the things that are going wrong. There's some people arriving late. Let's just show them for so the people at home can. So there they are. They were late. They couldn't be bothered to turn up on time, like everyone. Nearly everyone else turned up on time. And I got like an infected finger. I'll just show the people at home there. That's it. Yeah, good. But then it's been really, really hurting for a few days. But on the tube on the way here, I realised I could squeeze it and get all the poison out. So I'm going to... I'll see if I can get any more out. It's going to be... Could you hold that? Yeah, it's weeping slightly. Do you get that, David?
Yeah.
Good. There we go. So that... I'd forgotten all the fun of that. That is, do you remember that when you were kids? Things don't really get infected so much these days, certainly since I got married. So, perhaps squeezed the odd bit of pus out of there. But talking... Talking, it's always good fun. I once had a biopsy on the end of my penis. I had a stitch put on the end of my penis once. It was fantastic. That's for another day. The Brit Common Confessions has started giving some back. My guest last time was Robert Llewellyn, and there wasn't very much on there for him, but one has arrived for him, and I don't think, because obviously he hasn't been on the show yet, I don't think this is one that's been set up by someone, so I just thought I'd read this one. If you don't know, this is a site on the internet where people confess their what they want to do to various comedy figures, including, well, nearly everyone you can imagine, but also people like Stouffer, and when I say people like Stouffer. This is one of Robert Llewellyn's. I would get so turned on by Robert Llewellyn fucking me hard, making me wear the Crichton mask, and then shouting at me about my faulty socket, which is... I don't know if this is a man or a woman, but they're basically saying their vagina or anus or both don't work properly, and that's why he'd be fucking me going, why, what's wrong with your socket? Why is it not working properly? So that's quite... And the fact they want... Then they'll be wearing the Crichton mask. That's properly perverted. But there are a few new ones for me, and now I don't think we can trust these, because I think these are people, fans, who are aware that I will probably read them out. That's what they're going for. There's two or three have arrived in the last kind of couple of weeks. This one is quite interesting. I wish Richard Herring would fuck me right in the middle of a golf course. I don't know how precise they are about that, whether we would have to... Part of the experience would be working out where the middle of the golf course was. No, we can't do it here. This is not the actual... Let's get the surveying equipment out again. I'm up for that. Do you mind if I do that, Katie? My wife's in. Can I... Fuck yeah, I've got a thumbs up from my wife. As long as it's right in the middle of the golf course. If you come and catch me, like on the green of number two, I don't really know about what golf is. That isn't the middle, is it? Rich, by definition, number two, there are 18 holes. 19 if you include the bar. Hey, the butlers are in. They love a drink. I dream about Richard Herring using his tiny hands to take off all my clothes, then touch me with them. I do have quite small hands. I do discuss that, so that is a fan of mine. I suppose anyone who wants me to fuck them would be a fan of mine, would hope. I suppose if you're a real pervert, you'd want to have sex with a comedian you didn't like, which is why I want to have sex with Paddy McGuinness. Let my anus see your cock. That's what he would say. Basically what he says every week, but that is it, that's that show in a nutshell. And then another one, I'd like to melt a big bar of Cadbury Dairy Milk all over Richard Herring, then leave him to clean it up himself. I would quite like that, though I am on a diet, so I'd just have to wipe it off with a sponge, and I wouldn't be able to. I'd like to lick that sponge with the mixture of Cadbury's Dairy Milk and my own bodily hair. And there'd be pus in there. There'd be a little bit of pus. Let's crack on. We've got a fantastic first guest, so let's not waste any more time. He does not feature in Brit Comedy Confessions, which is a shame. I know he should do, but I think it's... Younger comedians tend to, under 50, comedians tend to face in there. Anyway, my guest, you will probably know him as Back from the TV series Arabian Nights. That is what he's best. That's what most of you have come to see him for tonight. Will you please welcome the incredible Alexi Sayle, ladies and gentlemen? Sit down. Pick up a mic and use it in your face. There we go, that's lovely. How are you doing?
I'm all right, thank you.
Good, lovely to see you. You've been a little bit of a cold as well. We've both been a bit under the weather. But it's all right, we can chill out and relax. We don't have to go.
Don't have to be entertained.
We don't have to be entertained. It's fine. So we'll get this out of the way, because this is what you must be asked in all your interviews. How was it being back well, in the Arabian Nights? It was a TV series.
It was just an acting job I did. It was back. It was the in the Arabian Nights was the Emir's favourite storytelling. He was a dwarf,
right?
What was the story now? He has dinner with a merchant and he chokes to death.
Right.
And then for the rest of... I can't remember how the rest of the story is them trying to get rid of his body.
Right.
So basically all of me was played by a rubber... They made a rubber version of me, like a small midget version of me in rubber, which I call Little Alexi. So all I did was go to this dinner party, eat like a peanut and collapse. And then the rest of the film the rest of the episode was... wasn't me, it was this rubber midget dwarf being carried around. But I showed a photograph of me and little Alexi to my mother, and she got us mixed up. She said, "That's you." And I said, "Fuck off, that's a rubber dwarf that looks like me." She said, "That's you."
She would know if anyone would know her own son.
You'd think that, but she didn't. She mistook me for a rubber dwarf.
So that's quite a good job, basically. You didn't, except presumably you have to be. Did you have to get your body covered in?
Yeah, they had to, you know, be covered in rubber and all that. But it was. You know, it was so. Yeah, it was. It was. So, yeah, I mean, it was. You know, to have yourself played by a. You know, something made out of rubber. It was, you know.
Well, we had Robert Llewellyn on last week. That's pretty much his career. So, so I was reading up about you, because we have talked before, so I wanted to try and talk about different things than before. Firstly, you were expelled from school, which I don't think we talked about before. And I wondered what reason you were expelled from sixth form. Is that right?
Halfway through the sixth form. Just for being a terrible troublemaker, really. I mean, they were quite... I think... there's nothing really funny in this story.
It doesn't have to be funny.
It's just that it's.
Did you do something really horrific? I killed a teacher. They said you can't say anymore.
I hit a teacher. Did that you? Was one of the things. Yeah, I hit a teacher. And he was, funnily enough, he was in the Communist Party. He was like my parents called Mr. Abrams.
Right.
And he hated me. He hated me all through the school, really, when he should have been looking out for me, because, you know, being the child of communists, but he always hated me.
Yeah, the communists, though, they kind of hate. It's like Trotsky and Stalin, they were both, they didn't like each other, did they? Yeah, at least you can get an ice pick.
True. And anyway, he pushed me in the tuck shop queue.
Right.
And, you see my protestations about going to a rough week at my school. Somewhat wider than mark. He pushed me in the tuck shop queue, and so I hit him, and then, so I had to go, and then, but there was other stuff. I think my favourite... The art teacher was leaving and was going to Quarry Bank, you know, where John Lennon that went. And so I wanted to go with him, which I don't think he was that keen on me. It'd be a bit weird, kind of like, you know, one of your pupils turn up. So they said, no, I couldn't go to Quarry Bank, but also I couldn't come back to my school either. It's like Tom Hanks film where he's stuck in the terminus, really. I'm stuck in a kind of educational limbo.
Stuck between all the Liverpool schools, just not being able to go out of that triangle.
Standing outside all of them, yeah.
But you went to Chelsea College of Art and Design.
I did, yeah.
But you didn't stay in the halls, so that was the mistake you made.
Oh yeah, well that's it was a terrible mistake. I had this friend called Wasim Abdullah, who was a Palestinian electronics engineer, and he had a flat in London in Queensgate in South Kensington, which was just I thought, well, it seemed nice. It wasn't. It was just a basement with an outside toilet, and he had the bed with like one or sometimes two girlfriends, and every bit of the floor around was like different Arabs. Apart from me, there was like down one side. And the thing that Wasim did as well, that he built his own a digital alarm clock, which was really advanced for like 1971, which was no good as a clock. But it was brilliant at killing mice. Because there was like these vibrations it gave off, and the mice would kind of come out like, and then they'd touch it, and it was, because it was very badly made as well, it would electrocute them. So there'd be this pile of corpses in the morning.
And no one cleaned them up because we were all students.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you were not scared horrible. About sleeping in a room with a sort of radioactive exploding alarm clock?
Wasn't it radioactive? It was just, if you touched it, you'd get a terrible shock.
And did he woke himself up by, he wired up a...
He had a car headlight on a tube, a cardboard tube that was like hung over his face. And then there was... a record player with the Maoist peeking off with the Easter's red on it, and the alarm clock would set. This is typical electronics engineering. It would set off any time between like 6 a.m. and 9:15. It would go off, and the light would shine in his face. Then this peeking opera would start with like, and he'd wake up and then go to work.
Did it? It presumably woke you up as well, though.
They're
rigging something like that. Though didn't someone do something like that? And they someone had something like a boulder that fell onto something, but then it fell on him. I can't remember it. Never mind. I'll edit me saying it properly in at the end, and it'll look amazing. Everyone, and then I'll edit a laughing, and it'll just go, they'll cut to you really laughing at something else. That was brilliant. It wasn't terrible like you thought. And the thing I'm interested in, because obviously you know all about the Comedy Store, and you've been the first MC of the Comedy Store, but you generally just answered an advert in the, was it in the Private Eye?
Yeah, my wife Linda saw an advert.
And just went along, and you became, you became the MC in the Comedy Store just by turning up and saying you could do it.
I auditioned, and I was the first person who wasn't sort of mentally ill, really, that they'd seen. So, but I mean, the comedy boom would have happened, you know, somewhere in Britain anyway, but not in that place, because, you know, I mean, they were very fortunate, I think, to have me, because I did have a pretty rare skill set then, one that I was doing alternative comedy before it existed. So, right. You know, I'd been doing it more or less by myself. You know, well, I had like a partner, you know, but we'd been just touring in this complete vacuum doing this material, which we assumed, you know, it was like about drugs and politics and stuff, which we assumed there was an audience for, but we didn't really know that there was. But also I also had this tremendous authority, you know, that I could, you know, because it was such a wild kind of place in the early days, the Comedy Store. And I was, you know, probably, you know, one of the few people that could have really imposed, kept that audience in line, really. So on the opening night and for the first few months, I had this kind of, you know, very aggressive comic persona anyway, but just I was very good at kind of maintaining a kind of chaos that never... quite, just always teetered on the edge of chaos, but never tipped over. But I was also, I think, which was a very, I was very, and all this just came intuitively, I was very honest that I would give an act a good build-up, but then if they failed, which they generally did, I was absolutely horrible about them. I mean, really vile, and that was... I mean, in retrospect, that was horribly... I mean, it's cruel, you know. But on the other hand, I think in that place at that time, it worked really well, you know, just to just be shitty about people.
And better than the other way around, which sometimes... Some MCs start off by going, I don't know who this guy is, he might be shit, you know. And right. if you start like that, then that's a lot more unfair. I think someone's died, you sort of have to...
Oh, yeah, you got to give them a build-up, but then afterwards, just really lay into them. So... they were very fortunate, I think, I suppose that's one of the magical things about, you know, artistic movements, that, you know, the right people do just appear, really, you know.
Yeah, well, if you hadn't, then it wouldn't be, we wouldn't be talking about it.
No,
certainly
no,
you and I wouldn't
it may be, yeah. But like, the world is ready, people are going, oh, I'd like to see some paintings with... you know, that, like people are sideways and they got three eyes. And then this guy comes and goes, "Hi, I'm Pablo Picasso. And I like to paint women sideways with three eyes."
This is fortuitous.
It's what they call a gestalt.
Yeah. Well, there was, it obviously was this time where there was a time for a change within the entertainment industry, which maybe we're at again, but in some ways, but it was I think like a lot of the young people won't remember the comedy of the 1970s, and even the stuff on TV was so offensive and racist and sexist and homophobic, and so I think there would have to be a kind of reaction to it. Well, it's good there was.
Yeah, and people, there was a different audience out there that wasn't being served. You know, you're getting this kind of, your first generation of people have been to university and were, you know, were left-wing, but also very consumerist, you know, and they were very keen to have their lifestyle kind of celebrated and mocked, I suppose, really. So, you know, it was, they weren't going to be served by, well, nobody will know these names, really, will they? But, you know, Colin Crompton of the Wheel Tappers and Shunters Social Club wouldn't be doing stuff about, you know, mocking people's habitat furniture, you know, they would, you know, or the, you know, the fissiparious nature of left-wing political groups. You know, Les Dawson was never going to be doing shit like that.
You know? You never know. He might have come round to it. But it was, I mean, I can imagine you were a very intimidating figure, because I've, you know, seen pictures of you as a younger man. I mean, you're quite a...
Yeah. Well, I'm not in real life, you know, but... That you know, there was something, I never really analysed it, but there was just the comic persona that had emerged, you know, in the couple of years I'd been doing sort of stand-up was very aggressive, and that was what I was interested in as a performer, was aggression, you know, winding the audience up. And that was just a perfect, you know, I mean, stuff that I'm completely uninterested in now, but that was, you know, that just worked fantastically well. And, you know, in a club that started at midnight, you know, it was cheap to get in.
Did it go on all night? Because I saw you was talking about, you would say, I would put people on at 4 a.m. if you didn't like it.
They got a bit nerves, yeah, it finished about 4 a.m.
Right.
Yeah.
Did people stay? Was it just a weekend thing?
I think it was basically only a Saturday night in the end. I probably finished about 12 to 1 once. It must have finished about 4 sometimes.
Incredible. And it was quite dangerous. You were talking about Keith Allen, who, you know, I am a big fan of, throwing darts into the audience.
Yeah.
Was that a regular occurrence, or was that a one-off?
No. Well, it was... No, he says it, I thought it was at Goldsmiths College. He says it was at the Royal College of Art.
Right.
But he did... My favourite one of, the thing about Keith was, the problem with him, he was very aggressive, very inventive, never did the same thing twice, but it wasn't that funny. That was the only, that's not a criticism.
When you were walking out with a dart in your head, going, I enjoyed most of his act, but I thought the dart throwing was too fun.
But it was an extraordinary, you know, you'd never seen nothing like that before. And again, he had that sense of, genuine sense of threat, you know, genuine, you know, sense of somebody who was kind of deranged, you know, who could go one way. Well, you know, he's physically very, again, it's like Arabian Nights. We did a show together at the Albany Empire in Deptford, and it was like Scheherazade, because I had to think of a different story every night to stop him getting his cock out on stage. Like, now you gotta say, oh, there's a party of nuns in tonight, you know, fair enough, you know. There's little kids, oh, my mum's in tonight. And then finally, one night, I just ran out of stories and I said, oh, fuck it, on you go. And he's one of those, he's one of those people, there was a lot of them, I don't know if they're still, who, a lot of performers who like nothing more than taking all their clothes off.
Yeah.
I mean, Keith was one, Terry Jones, Tony Robinson's another, Simon Callow, I think. It's a kind of a subset of performers who love getting naked, and you know, finally I ran out of reasons to stop him, and there he was start bollock naked performing, you know.
He does do it a lot. I mean, you say he never does the same thing twice, but he does take his cock out an awful lot.
With the exception.
That's pretty much every story.
Yeah.
He wants to see my cock. It's where that whole story came from originally. And one of the first things I heard you in, and I guess, was this: you're in the Secret Policeman's Other Ball, which is an Amnesty International benefit that I listened to on a little cassette tape that you could buy cassettes in those days and listen to them like that.
Yeah.
And that was you. So you were in amongst, because it was quite, that was again quite a lot of the Oxbridge comedians. The various Peter Cook and the John Fortune and those kind of people, and John Cleese.
Yeah, it was. Well, it was sort of. It was an odd experience. I was like massive in London. I mean, the Comedy Store, and then I think I was at the Comic Strip at that point. It was massive in London, but not really. Well, you didn't know whether you were known outside London, really. But and so, well, it was my ex-manager, my manager, who's producing it. But I think also they wanted to have who was obviously at the cutting edge of comedy, and so they asked me to be in the 1981. Yeah. I mean, I didn't. Cleese didn't like me much. His wife, you know, he's married like 17 different American blonde psychoanalysts, and this was like number 8. She hated me. But I can't. It's funny because I'm working on volume 2 of my memoir at the moment now. But I remember having a big row with Jasper Carrot about, because we both had a gag that finished with the punchline Guildford. And he said, well, I want to say Guildford, and I said, well, I want to say Guildford. So finally I said, who's on first? He said, you. I said, well, fuck you then. I said Guildford. It fucking killed. He changed his to Hatfield, and it fucking died on its own.
That's no good.
Because we both knew that Guildford was the only possible, you know. He couldn't do anything, you know, it's just one of them things where you know, it's one of them things where you know the only thing you can say is, Guildford!
Yeah. Hatfield, it's completely wrong.
Yeah, he went, Hatfield! And went, he was alright about it. He was a nice bloke, you know.
But I bet in his heart as well. If you know in your heart it's not as funny, it doesn't work as well. That's the problem.
Sell it, maybe, yeah.
So you know it's going to come up to that. That's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
And also, like one of my other guests and myself, although mine is slightly less high profile than yours, you've played Trinculo in The Tempest. I may have talked. As has Russell Brand. You were in a Jonathan Miller.
Yeah.
Was it a stage production or a film?
It was the old Vic.
Yeah.
It was Max von Sydow was Prospero.
Right.
And Rudy Davis, who was one of Bella Bramage's daughters, was Miranda. And all the Islanders were black. So Cyril Unruh was Ariel. And Rudy Davis was Caliban.
I did it at the Kings of Wessex School Hall. Steve Cheek was Caliban. John Butler was Stefano. Yeah, no one. Steve Cheek works as he was in God and Jesus with. Do you remember when Simon Munnery? I mean, you might not have been around, and then in Edinburgh, but Simon Munnery and him used to do a double act called God and Jesus, which I think they were meant to be God and Jesus. Can you still remember any of the Trinculo speeches?
No, I did have I did think for a while that I would only go to productions of The Tempest and then leave after Trinculo had been on. No, I can't remember a thing now. I put in an extra line, which was bastards.
Right.
bastards. And Jonathan Miller was very keen on me, you know, doing that. So
yeah. And what was he like to work with? I saw him in the street it's kind of astonishing to see him still going along.
He was very much at the height of his fame.
Yeah.
So, and it was the sort of thing people did. So sometimes you'd say, you know, coming for rehearsals in the afternoon, you'd say, where's Jonathan? They'd say, he's gone to Boston to, like, direct an opera, and he'll be back tomorrow.
Right.
So he was all right. He didn't, you know, we didn't really hit it off, you know. Max von Sydow sent me Christmas cards for years afterwards. Yeah. Just nice, he wasn't Death, was he? He played chess with Death in the
Ingmar
Bergman film. But, yeah. So Max von Sydow sent me a Christmas card for years after that production.
And you, this is interesting. Now I've won a Sony Award, and you won a Sony Award in 1979. But in 1979, they were called the Pi Awards.
The Pi Radio Awards.
It was the Paedophile Information Exchange Award. It was back in the 70s, yeah. It was all right. No one. They could sponsor radio awards, but just let the paedophiles have a. Let them have an award. It's all right. It won't be when this goes out. Did they do gold, silver, and bronze then, or was it just you won?
I think I just won it. Yeah.
For Alexis Sale and the Fish People.
Yeah, it was a thing I did for Capital Radio. I can't remember much about it really, but I won two awards that year, and in both, the chairman of the judging panel in his speech began it by saying, "It's been a very poor year."
I see that someone on this list did not even go to Oxbridge. That is how.
That was a fucking subtext. Fuck you.
St. Catherine's College, Oxford. I'll ask you an emergency question, not that we need it, but just to change the tone. Would you rather have a tit that dispensed talcum powder, a nipple?
Yeah.
It'd be a nipple with a breast behind it full of talcum powder. That any as much as you wanted, an infinite amount of talcum powder, you'd never have to buy talcum powder again. Which is probably true, even if you didn't have the. Or a finger that could travel through time, but just your finger. But you can send it anywhere in time and space, and you'd be able to see where it was, and you could do a small amount of stuff with it.
No contest. I mean, because I've got a tin of talcum powder.
You've got a tin or a tit?
A tin.
Yeah, I got a tin.
But it's metal. It's so old.
Yeah.
It's got like an offer on it for like a horse whip or something. Like, spats. It really is. I sometimes look at it because I think this is really old. This. One of the things I really like is finding stuff that's really past its sell-by date.
Yeah.
You know, like finding a tin of kind of Borlotti beans from Safeways. It doesn't exist anymore. It gives me a tremendous sense of pleasure that I don't know why. You know, and then to eat them as well. I mean, I love well out of date stuff for itself. But no, obviously a finger.
What would you do? What would you use your finger for in time?
See stuff,
Yeah, but you'd be able to see it with just through the hole. You wouldn't be able to. It would just be your finger.
It's something, though, isn't it? Really?
It's something for your finger to be there.
See,
you could do stuff, though. I don't see how.
Does it make a hole and then you pull it out and then the kind of gap remains for a bit?
Well, no, I think it would. That would be ridiculous. I think it would. It would close quite quickly. So you could go and you could look through and see. So you wouldn't just be poking around and not know where it's going. You'd be able to see around and then just...
Around your finger.
Okay, I'm going to poke Julius Caesar in the bum or something. Or go, oi, watch out. Look behind you. You could shout through and you might get a little bit of... It's a tinny. Watch out, Julius Caesar. Yeah, they're going to stab you.
Yeah, that'd be fantastic.
It'd be good, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that'd be brilliant.
Yeah. What if...
That's not... If, I mean, I think you're going to have to rethink that question.
Why? That's a good question.
Well, there's too much of a disparity between...
That's what I like about it.
Oh, really?
Two people are still
chosen...
Because
the one you asked me in the dressing room, which was a hand of ham, or what was the other...
Sun cream armpit, yeah.
Well, they're pretty... So there's a parity there.
But sometimes it's interesting to see.
A tit, which is feasible, a tit that dispenses talcum powder... It's a possibility, but a finger that we're stepping well outside the laws of time and physics.
Well,
because
there are wormholes in space, so you could find a wormhole and you could get your finger through it. Okay, try this.
Talking to Robin Ince.
Try this one. if your penis could travel in time, through a similar wormhole, who would you have sex with? In the past or the future, it could be, or just.
That is just like a glory hole. This is like a...
It is.
It's a time-travelling glory hole.
It is. Yeah. Now, I think there would have to be some system where you could communicate with the... Because I don't want you to... I have the idea of Alexei Sale putting his cock through a wormhole and, you know, Catherine of Aragon's there and you go, "Hey, get into that." I think Catherine... I bet Catherine of Aragon would have to go, "Well, yes, I am willing to take the..." If it was... That, I'm not saying she's a slag, Catherine of Aragon, because if anything, quite the opposite. She was very... she hardly even had sex with her husband. But I'm just saying, I don't want it to turn into a, you know, into an unpleasant scenario, a sort of boat that rocked scenario. I want it to be... I want it to be a consensual...
Right. How is consent obtained?
Well, we'd have to do some kind of... You'd whisper through, you'd go, "Hello, it's me, Alexei Sale." Maybe you could put through a rolled up copy of your book or something. So they could read that. "Oh yeah, he's an interesting guy. I like him. I'd like to have sex with his disembodied penis from the past or future." Yeah. That's how I imagine this would work. And then you would put your penis through and you could have sex with it. Well, who would you have sex with? In no circumstances. It's not exactly the same question as which historical figure would you have sex with? Because there is this thing where it's just your disembodied penis. And the way you're looking at me is if this is as if I'm wasting your time. Like as if you haven't been asked this before.
You did what you did.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us. mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Get me to it. She was just having sex with Chris... Keith Allen, didn't you, in Edinburgh.
That's so 2013. That we've moved on now. This is a very different question. Yeah. Is there anyone in history you would like to have...
Anybody nice.
Yeah, anyone nice.
Somebody nice would do. Is not Hitler.
Not Hitler. You could teach him a lesson, couldn't you? You could teach Hitler a lesson. He might like it. Good. Well, we'll get back to do you find that like lots of middle-aged men approach you quoting stuff from the young ones at you a lot? Revolutionary biscuits a bit early, rise up out of your boxes, you have nothing to lose but your wafers, that kind of thing. Does that happen a lot to you?
Yeah.
Is that the bit they usually do to you, that bit?
Or there it's one bits? Of them, yeah. I was doing a video thing for Telegraph, and we were up in Hull, and I was just going to have my photograph taken with the train crew, you know, just as a courtesy to Hull trains, and the photographer said, "Can you pull one of your funny faces?" No, not really. often it's also they're not necessarily, you know, a lot of them are kids and stuff, that they're young people that they're you know, their parents or grandparents have, you know, turned them on to the young ones. Yeah. So, it's, you know, there's not necessarily an age thing to it. You know, I mean, when I was doing, you know, when I did stand up last year, you know, which was very gratifying, the majority of the audience were under 35, you know, I don't know what the fuck they were doing there. I thought maybe I was on like the GCSE syllabus or something. You know, so no, that was very gratifying, really, because I mean, the thing that I wouldn't do it if I thought that I just appeal to, you know, my own kind of demographic, really. You know, so,
yeah.
You
know.
But you're saying, I think, that with the young ones kind of broke you through into sort of mainstream in a way that if maybe that hadn't happened. I mean, because it was always a weird thing, because you were basically did your own bit in the young ones mainly, didn't you? You mainly cut to you and you did a routine, basically.
Yeah, but I think it was, I mean, it's hard to know, really, but I think that, I'd done some telly beforehand. I mean, mainly this late night thing called OTT, which had been a bit of a controversial kind of... I think I felt that I needed to be in something with people, you know, with like-minded people that appealed to the youth audience, you know, to our audience, but also that got a kind of, you know, that was highly regarded critically, which Young Ones wasn't at first, but gradually it was, you know. But obviously the Young Ones was also, you know, was a highly, you know, was an extraordinarily intelligent piece of writing, you know, so a wonderful, I mean, regardless of whether I'm in it or not, it's a fantastic piece of work, I think.
I think, but also, it goes back to there being nothing like that before. So as a whatever I was, 14 or 15-year-old school kid, seeing this stuff coming in, and you would wait years for something to come on for you on TV. It would be like 3 years since Not That O'Clock News, or whatever, 4 years, and there'd be no other programme for young people, and then this would come on. Yeah. And so it was mind-blowing for our generation.
I think it must have been,
generation.
Yeah, I mean, if you were you, which
I was.
You were, which you did a great job.
I mean,
you did a wonderful. I imagine you were fantastic at that. But I imagine, it must have been the most thrilling thing to see the Young Guns, because it was good, you know. I think it still stands up. It's not, you know, it's just so dense, so full of brilliant shit, I think.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's. I think it must have been marvellous to see, and, you know, and reflected the spirit of the age and stuff, you know. And also, you know, that thing, I mean, it was like the BBC, some of them episodes went on for like 35 minutes, you know, and there'd be like, you know, the invasion of the Ukraine or something. They just pushed the news back because, you know, the Young Ones was running, you know, just whatever, you can make it about days, you know. Like everything now has to be 29.73 you know, seconds, kind of thing, you know.
It was good. It was a happy time. The world was a better place back in the 1980s. Apart from, you know, the paedophile information exchange. Apart from that, it was much better. And you talked about OTT, because that was an interesting one as well. Because I think the other comedy show that really probably first blew my mind was Tiz Was, which was, and OTT was the sort of adult version of that. But it was slightly misjudged, probably, in the kind of beauty of Tiz Was that it was an adult show, but it was a kid show.
It was adults just being horrible to kids, really. You know, in the guise of a kid show, so you were in on the joke, but you know, the adult viewer was in on the joke, whereas with OTT, there was no joke to be in on, as it were, and it was very. You know, I remember, like, the show used to go out on the Saturday, and they'd start sort of thinking about sketches for that week's show on the Friday. So it was very laid back. And I mean, Chris Tarrant's taste and all the other people, Bob Carroll G's and Spit the Dog, they were... well, Spit the Dog liked me, but Carroll G's didn't. That they, you know, they soon developed a rift. You know, I refused. I was supposed to be one of the players. I was supposed to be in the sketches, but they were so bad, I just said, I'm not fucking being in any of these sketches. Yeah. You know? So that was a point of tension, you know. And so I'd just come on, do my bit. And also it was live and, you know, I didn't think, I mean, but I personally was criticized. That year's ITV, the report of the commission that oversaw ITV,
yeah,
you know, the kind of the supervisory body, the ICC or whatever it was, specifically mentioned me. Right. And some of the stuff I'd said as being a kind of low point in television that year. Right. A kind of regulatory nightmare.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think I did probably cause a lot. I mean, I caused Chris a lot of grief just with some of the stuff I improvised.
Right.
You know.
It wasn't. It doesn't seem like a natural marriage between...
No, I mean, yeah. I shouldn't have done it, really. And that's one of the things where you don't know... Well, I was so desperate to be on the telly that I kind of, you know, kind of accepted it, but suspecting that it really wasn't the right thing for me to be in. And now, I mean, that's one of the things. I mean, younger comics now, you know, they judge things better, don't they? They say, no, I'll wait until...
Yeah, well, sometime. I mean, I think, you know, there's an element where I think people should just have a crack and do stuff. I think you can get... You can be too choosy as well, and you can be too like, oh, I'm not going to do that, I'm not going to do that. That's what about being... I don't think comedians should really have to be cool, really, because they're not, they're comedians.
So I suppose I just felt that I depended on a kind of... a certain kind of status, you know, and a not... So, you know, and if I did something that was too demeaning, then that would...
Yeah.
That would destroy... You know, because, when it wasn't quite... You know, I wasn't there yet, you know. I wasn't quite a star, and so I worried terribly that I would do something that, you know, that would destroy my status, and I'd never...
Yeah.
There, you know?
Well, yeah, it was... I mean, I think you're right. It wasn't... you left it, didn't you? So I think that was the right choice. Yeah. All I remember is, because I was 14 or 13 or whatever at the time, was naked girls sort of getting up on tables and jumping around.
Yeah,
which,
it was a lot. But
So I was distracted away from your bits by that.
Well, the big hit on the opening night was Malcolm Hardy in The Greatest Show on Legs. Did the balloon dance, you know. And again, did naked, you know, you saw their cocks. That was a bit my mother said was best. That's the bit she liked the best.
Malcolm Hardy's cock.
Yeah, a familiar sight again. He's another one to add to that list, wasn't he, really?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So,
isn't it weird how alcoholics choose to live on houseboats? You know, there's a lot of alcoholics. If you're an alcoholic, you think, I'm a heavy drinker. To get home, I'm going to cross a rickety bridge over mud flats that will suck me under until I, no matter how much I struggle, I will drown. You know, that's the fucking gaff for me, isn't it? That's where I'm going to live, and that's what Malcolm did when he drowned.
He did. Well, you sort of wonder whether that was part of the plan, because I don't think he would have enjoyed being old, you know.
Now, when I read the autopsy report, it was on Wikipedia, I think, but the police report said he was found with a bottle of beer clutched in his hand, face down in the mud like that with a bottle, you know.
The beer was more important.
He probably could have got free, but he wouldn't let go of the beer.
Got to keep his thumb in the top to make sure no water gets in there.
Somebody said as well, I don't know if it's apocryphal, that he'd won really big on the one-armed bandit that night. So right. his pockets were full of change.
We're laughing affectionately at the death of a man. It's all part of the legend. It does become part of the legend. He was a legendary guy. Tell me about... I'm interested in your last gig in 1996. You were in Perth.
Yeah.
And you decided to give up doing stand-up comedy in Perth, which is... this is the Australian Perth.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is possibly understandable, but do you remember much about that day?
No, I'd I'd been very unhappy with the tour, really. That I toured in 95 in Britain, and that had sort of gone all right, really, but the tour of Australia in 96, I'd done a tour in maybe 90 or 92 in Australia, where it was the only time that ever happened to me where all the gigs sold out right away, and we put in extra nights like I did. 5 nights at the State in Sydney and 3 nights at the Concert Hall in Melbourne and like 5 nights in Perth and stuff. And when I went back in 96, whatever reason, that wasn't the case really. That we did all the gigs that we were booked and they were all sold out, but there was no extra, you know, it was no, for whatever reason, there wasn't a buzz there. So that was dispiriting. And also, I just reached the end of what I could do with that persona really. And I didn't know how to to move on from it. So I was just very, I was just unhappy. I mean, the shows were funny and stuff, but I was just very unhappy with what I was doing, really. Yeah. So,
Well, I think Austin happens a lot. I mean, I guess it's the hotel rooms of being around the world. I mean, Hancock killed himself in Australia. If we go back to another hilarious comedy death. But, but I think you can understand it, especially if you're, if you're a thinker and a depressive, when you get stuck in those hotels in the other side of the world as well.
Yeah,
if the gigs aren't going great.
Yeah.
It is quite depressing.
Yeah, it wasn't... it wasn't that. I mean, there was a bit of that. But, I mean, it wasn't... it was also... I think I felt... Yeah, because the stand-up I did last year, I just loved it so much because it had a kind of... because I was just... It was anecdotal and I was being me and it was complex, I felt happy with the material where there was always an element... particularly towards the end of what I was doing before in the tight suit and all that, it was kind of grotesque. There was a kind of... I was doing bits sort of to get laughs, really, a bit. I mean,
it's still making it... It's an awful thing for a comedian to do.
To get...
to not
well,
go
still
for
in
laughs.
Still in a way that, still while doing, material about Bertolt Brecht and stuff like that, so it wasn't like I was really pandering to the audience, but I just felt that there wasn't a kind of, I was just itching to really do material that was much more complicated, really, and I knew I couldn't do that. I thought I couldn't do that via stand-up comedy.
Right. And that's kind of interesting. I think it's also interesting to have, you obviously didn't do stand-up for a long time and now you've come back to it, but I think in a sense having that fallow time, and it happens. It's sort of, Stuart had it to an extent where he sort of gave up doing stand up for 2 or 3 years, and then came back to it. And in a way, to have not necessarily a failure, but I think you're looking at the people you worked with, and they've gone on to do different things and become sort of successful in their own right. And then it's kind of dispiriting. But actually, to become good as a artist, as a comedic artist, you sort of need the failure or to regroup a little bit, perhaps.
Definitely, yeah. No, I mean, I don't. I became an author really after a few years of sort of thrashing about. My first, selection of short stories came out in about, I think, 1999, and I was entranced with being an author for a good 12 years, and so it's only slowly that I went back to stand up, but. I don't know. Some people can keep doing it and evolve, but through doing book readings, I'd found a whole new way to do stand-up. And it was, it was just something that I was just terribly happy with, when I went back to it, really. But, it doesn't do any harm to have... That kind of those dips in your career.
And also, I think if you don't experience failure, though, and if everything... Well, it sort of, you turn into... I think for me, that's what's happened to Ben Elton. He hasn't experienced failure. He's been able to do everything you ever want to do.
Yeah.
And then you just don't move... You don't grow as an artist, and then you suddenly do something that people go, oh, no, that's just terrible. So,
you're certainly experiencing it now.
Yeah, yeah. So, which I'm sure you're not delighted about. but I think that is, you get to the point where everyone's saying yes, and do this, and actually you've got to be knocked back and go, oh, so actually I can't just put the first draft of this sitcom in and put that out. I have to go back and write a second draft. Wow. I think that to be knocked back probably helps you.
I think you're making a virtue of that, aren't you?
For myself.
Your own stuttering career. You're trying to say, it's better to be like
I
this.
I haven't gone up again, though. I've just kind of gone down.
It's bumping along the bottom. It's an interesting analysis of what went wrong with Ben, and that's probably true. For me, a lot of the stuff I did was tried to do was so odd or so stupid that it was never going to succeed, really, so I was always going to experience a lot of failure. I only ever had that one tour in Australia where everything sold out. I never had that, even when at the height of my height in Britain. There was always, like we were talking backstage, there was always a couple of gigs that didn't sell out, where you'd have to go and fucking radio. So, you know, you'd have to go up, you know, go up to fucking Bournemouth a day early to do local radio to try and sell the seats, you know, and which is something that I hated. So I never really, I don't really think I had that experience of kind of unfettered success ever, more or less, really, you know.
But then I think you're also quite hard on yourself, and I think, you know, it's both wanting to be, you know, do the best you can be as a comedian and be an amazing comedian, but also there is all part of every comedian, I think, that still wants to be loved and successful. And yeah. So there's an odd kind of dichotomy there that you're almost fighting internally between yourself, it feels
to me. Yeah. I did make it. I mean, it was very uncompromising, my show. I would, you know, if I felt things were getting too cosy, I would sort of turn on the audience and so on, and so it wasn't, you know, wasn't easy.
But you are also doing, like, you know, you were in major movies and acting and Indiana Jones, you're in Gorky Park.
Yeah, my first one. Yeah, but I was never in one that, like, really, you know, I mean, apart from the Indiana Jones, I was never really
Indiana
in one.
Jones did all right. That was okay.
That was okay. But I was only, like, a tiny part in that. I never really had that. As an actor, I never really quite, you know, got that great role already, you know.
No. But there's a lot, I just feel with acting, there's so much luck in A, in getting cast, but B, in the thing becoming successful. And then if the thing is successful, you're sort of made and people will employ you forever on the basis of something that someone else wrote anyway. It's an odd job.
Yeah, I guess, yeah. It might have been nice if I'd, you know, if I'd had that. I mean, it's, you know.
There's still time.
Yeah, who knows?
Carry on, Columbus was close. Yeah.
My episode of New Tricks that I did in 2012, that might win a kind of special BAFTA for something.
So apparently you see certain, I mean, you did a recent interview where you talked quite candidly about the comedians you like and the comedians you don't like.
Yeah.
But luckily, I just nipped into what you call your comedy children.
Yeah. I had to do a bit of apologetic emailing after that. You know, I sometimes think with, like, doing those, like, that it was at the Leicester Comedy Festival. Yeah. You sometimes think, you forget these days that, you know, it's not just the people in the room who are watching, you know, it's everything goes everywhere, you know, so
Feel free to slag anyone else off that you like. If you are my comedy dad, though, can you send me some money on my birthday?
No, I'll send you an educational present. So it's good for you.
That would be good.
That's the other thing about, you sometimes forget when you're doing stuff like this or like that talk at the Leicester Comedy Festival, is that people expect you to kind of listen to yourself and to sort of believe what you say.
Yeah.
Which is never, as particularly in terms of having opinions, I've always just kind of said stuff really Have I never snagged you off, you and Stuart?
I don't. You might have done. I don't think you have, actually. I think we didn't really make enough of an impact to be snagged off. And then by the time you heard of us, we were doing, you know, quite good stuff. So.
Yeah. If you'd been more successful in your early days, I would have said something shitty about you. I don't know, I mean I quite like it when, I mean, I don't mind, you know, I quite like people who've been horrible about me. I rather like that. You know, I sort of respect them for that.
I think to get any reaction is a good thing. I mean, you can understand if a respected comedy figure blames you for the entire downfall of comedy. But I did. I was being interviewed for a podcast yesterday, and because it's like this, they go on so long, you just sort of start saying something, and then you go, but on the other hand, I totally disagree with what I've just said.
Yeah, yeah. And sometimes it's something you sort of believed, like, in 1997, but you don't believe it anymore, but you've forgotten that you don't believe it anymore. You know, I mean, so you just find yourself saying it.
Yeah. Okay, I'll go for an emergency question. I don't know if I asked you this one before. If I did, we'll just gloss over it. Alexi said, this is terrible that I have to ask this question. I don't have to, but I'm going to. You are one of my comedy heroes. Have you ever tried to suck your own cock?
No.
Well, you must have done.
No. I'm not that, you know. I know I'm not that limber. Is it possible? Is footage of Michael Flatley doing it? Isn't it?
Then Michael Flatley allegedly. You're going to have to email Michael Flatley. Sorry, I said you could. I think there is a picture of him somewhere. Doing it. If you
I knew it was never possible.
Really. I think it is. It is possible. In fact, it is possible. I may have mentioned this before in this podcast. I apologise if I do. But this, I did a whole book about penises and a show about penises. And in my research, I discovered it's possible for certain people to get a semi-erection that they can stretch round and have anal sex with themselves.
Really?
It's a beautiful act of love. Self-love. There was a story about a man in a Russian prison, you know, like a bin, and then he was obviously a bit crazy.
Yeah.
And he sat all day. Well, I mean, if you could, maybe you would. David, do you think? No, David doesn't seem to think so. You'd be something to pass the time. If you were in a Russian prisoner of war camp or gulag or whatever, then you know, it would pass the time, wouldn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
So true. It is possible to do. It is possible, but I've, you know. When you're a younger man doing, you know, you're a limber younger man. I'm not going to ask you to try it now. Okay. I'll ask you another emergency question because I need one after that emergency question. have you ever seen a ghost?
Have I ever seen a ghost?
Yeah.
No, I don't really believe in them, so I mean... No.
Doesn't mean you don't have to believe in it to see it. You can still give the...
Well, I don't know then, do I? Really? I've never seen nothing that seemed like a ghost. Yeah. I've never had any kind of paranormal experiences whatsoever. No, nothing.
Have you ever seen a Bigfoot?
No.
You know, we were taking a chance with that. I'll tell you what I was going to ask. What's the... These have got a couple of stand-up-based questions. Yeah. What is your worst... Have you got a worst hotel... travelling experience and touring in a hotel bed and breakfast or wherever you stayed whilst travelling?
I was thinking about this the other day that I used to, because I had a little band called Studio 2 who do the support and do my music, and I used to stay in the hotel Swank de Posh, and I used to put them where all the dolies went, you know. They used to stay in like the B&B where all the claimants went.
Right.
So they had some pretty terrible experiences.
Plus you were in your big palatial...
I was eating consomme.
Because we stayed in some pretty terrible... Me and Stu once stayed in a bed and breakfast where we had to share a room, and we had twin beds with pink covers on and a little canopy going between the two. It was very sweet. I wish we'd taken a photo of that. And recently I stayed in a travelodge when I went into my room and there was someone else's bogey on the shower curtain.
Oh yeah, I
That's pretty nasty.
Early days, I played Dublin with Alternative Cabaret, and Linda had got an Irish. She paid 50p to find out an Irish tourist board recommended hotel,
right,
which was this place called the Adelphi. And remember the bloke showing us up the stairs, and there was no bulb. There was a broken fish tank in the lobby, and there was no bulb on the stairs, and we just showed into this horrible room, and I noticed there was writing kind of carved into the wardrobe, and it said, you know, obviously the chalk outline of a body on the floor. You know? It said on the wardrobe, it said, if you think the room's bad, wait until you have the breakfast.
Oh dear. Once when I was in Swansea, I've definitely said this before, the toilet was in the same room as the bed. There used to be a cupboard.
Oh right, yeah.
But it wasn't big enough to fit a toilet in, and there was no door in it.
Yeah.
So the toilet was just in a very slight alcove. Just so you were here, and just I didn't stay in that. I got a lift home. Went back to London. Oh dear, happy days. And the thing I enjoyed you saying in your recent interview was that Benedict Cumberbatch is a wonderful actor, but if my cat had the facilities he had at Eton, my cat could be in Sherlock.
Yeah. Yeah. Was pointed out he went to Harrow, but it's still subsequently the same. But yeah, no, I was reading some interview with Ralph Fiennes, you know, somebody was saying to him about. You know, all the posh actors. He's going, oh, you know, class is the curse of Britain. You know, if you're a good actor, you're going to work. I mean, fuck off. I mean, it's not... You know, at Eton, they have their own studio theatre. They have a seamstress. They have, you know, a permanent director. And so, they are all fine actors. Tom Hiddleston, you know, Damien West, Dominic West, Damien Lewis, you know. all those people, they are very, very good actors, but they are taking somebody out. You know, they would have done something else, you know, years ago. They wouldn't have gone into acting, they would have gone into the city or whatever. They are taking the roles of working class.
Well, and also actors. They can afford, because I think it's harder ever to get into these, both comedy and acting now, because there's a lot of stuff to get through. So if you don't have, you know, they've got an income that they can survive on, and just go, I'll go and live with my mum and dad while I'm doing this. But, you know, if you can't, when I moved to London, we could hire a, you know, rent out a house and pay 50 quid a week and just about survive on that.
Yeah.
But now you'd have to live outside of London, basically, on what we were earning back then, and so you don't get, if you're rich, you can.
Yeah, and it's just ride that, you know, sort. It's just terribly unfair. I mean, if you've got all those advantages, then you know you are going to use them and that. But don't pretend it's not, you know, it's not an injustice, because it is, you know. And it also, I think it does, you know, as I said, I think it skews the narrative. You have, if the people from a very narrow socioeconomic band are telling our stories back to us, then it kind of, you know, there's a whole, the majority of experience and most people is excluded from that, really, you know, in terms of, you know, it's just unjust, you know.
And what I love about comedy and stand-up comedy, if it works, is that it doesn't matter what background you've come from. You've got to be able to make people laugh. And I love that when you're in a room full of guys and you go, oh, you did this, you did this, you did this.
Yeah.
But it is increasingly becoming, and you were at this university and you were at this university, which I suppose is partly because more people go to university. But it's also, it seems a shame that there isn't that variety. But how do we address that?
I don't know, it's difficult because, you know, I think people's parents now, they think, you know, it's an okay job to be a comedian now, and you see you're getting your Jack Whitehalls and your Miranda Arts and stuff like that, and you're getting all these posh actors because it's okay, it's what they want to do now, and they push aside, you know, people with less air resources. I don't know, it's not, you know, you can't have quotas or I don't know what you can do about it, really, apart from go on. You know, there's that scene in, I always love that scene in The Sopranos where Carmela goes to see this old kind of old-fashioned Jewish psychiatrist, and she tells him right away what her husband does, Tony Soprano does, and he says, well, you must leave him. And she says, well, you know, makes excuses. And he says, no, he gives her money back, and he says, you know, just, you know, stay with him if you want, but don't pretend you weren't told, you know, don't pretend you didn't know. And it's the same with, all you can do is say this stuff is unfair, you know, the kind of class, but you know, the nature of how all the actors now are being to Eton O'Hara, you know. And more than that, I don't know what you do about it, really.
Yeah,
I can't suggest policy, you know.
Well, I think, you know, the Conservatives are shutting down drama in schools. I think they're talking about getting rid of the drama O level, and so
maybe, I don't know, maybe, you know, we're class kids going to engineering or something more sensible, you know.
Yeah, well, that's a good point.
Yeah.
And most British drama is just really posh people in old houses, so maybe it's good.
Maybe it's good
that the posh just get to play themselves. Oh dear, well that's depressing. We'll wrap it up. So you've been in Doctor Who,
yeah?
Which
Revelation of the Daleks, 1987.
Which Doctor?
The best Doctor, I think, Colin Baker.
Colin Baker.
Really, the definitive. You know, Peter Capaldi is a very, very good friend of mine, and I was telling him that, you know, the Colin Baker is definitely the best Doctor. Really, for a long time, I was the last person killed by a Dalek. But he said, I think some of the same people are still playing the Daleks now as were when I did it in 1987.
Yeah.
Because they're all sort of ex-dancers. Right. For some reason the BBC thought when they had these, because they just move them around with their feet, you know. We need dancers to do this. They were young when they hired them in the, you know, when they, for the Daleks first appeared. They were like 20-year-old boys from the chorus, and now they're in their 70s or whatever, but they're still kind of, they're the same guys.
I did an audio Doctor Who adventure. Colin Baker was the Doctor.
Okay.
But then I insulted him because I made a joke about, in one of my newspaper columns, about him. He takes things very, very seriously. Yeah, I talked about, I mean, I made some joke about him being not the best Doctor Who.
and you had to do well,
it was very light.
Did you have to apologise to
I tweeted him, said, look, I'm a massive, I know, I work with you, and actually we were a big fan, and we put him in Time General Please, the thing I wrote, the sitcom I wrote, and he came in and did a cut, and I was saying, look, you know, we are, I was only joking, it's a big fan. No, that's another person I have to cut off and never
really?
Speak to again. Cunt. So you can't bear grudges, can you, Lexi?
I don't. No, I don't. I can't. I don't think I do.
Well, look, it's been absolutely fantastic for you to do this and meet you again. Thank you for coming when you haven't been, when you're a little bit ill. Ladies and gentlemen, Alexi Sale! Alexi Sale. Unbelievable. You have been listening to Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast with me, Richard Herring, and my guest, Alexi Sale. What the fuck? The music you're listening to was recorded by Pest. They are a good band. Thanks to Orange Mark at the British Comedy Guide and everyone at the Leicester Square Theatre and Chris Evans, not that one, or the one from the Avengers, or that bloke from your school. No, the one from Wales. It was produced by Ben Walker. It's a Fuzz, Go Faster Stripe and Sky Potato production. Thanks for listening to Rich Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast. That was me doing it. It was good, wasn't it? I don't know yet, because I've recorded this before we did it. It might have been terrible. I probably wasn't, though. I think it's definitely the best one we've ever done. If you would like to contribute, do go to gofasterstripe.com, where you can buy series passes of this and all the other video series we've done. You can just make a contribution. You can make a monthly contribution. You can download Richard Herring's Meaning of Life. Why not give that a go? That's a longer version. It's available from Go Faster Stripe. It's free online, but then you can get an extra 45 minutes if you're willing to pay. Or come and see me on tour, richardherring.com. We're All Going to Die is my current tour. Depends when you're listening to this, though. You know, for a couple of years in the future. Hello, what's it like? Oh, have you got hoverboards yet? I might be dead. Oh, my new tour is amazing. And I'm in the Edinburgh Fringe doing two shows. One of them's called Lord of the Dance Settee. One of them's called I Killed Rasputin. So check those out if you're at the Edinburgh Fringe 2014. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Thanks for listening. RichardHerring.com/gigs. GoFasterStripe.com for all my books, downloads, all that sort of shizzle. Oh, yeah, I know all the cool words. And would love to see you on the Can I Have My Ball Back tour if you can make it. Bye.